So, good evening and welcome back to our four-week course of Decisions of Fate. Tonight is Lesson 3, titled Pregnancy Questions. Maybe a little more accurately would be to call it Abortion Questions. So, I know a couple of the doctors, for, of course, separate reasons, are going to be absent today. We'll have a great time together. That said, a couple of words of introduction about what this class is tonight and what tonight's class is not. So, of course, it's a very highly sensitive topic, and there's currently, almost always, a heated debate going on in the U.S. about what the law should be regarding access to abortion. And I want to make clear that tonight's class is not about what public policy should be when it comes to abortion. It's an important question, an important conversation, independent of anything we're going to be talking and discussing tonight. Tonight we're going to be speaking strictly about what the Jewish approach is, what Jewish law has to say about this topic. We're going to delve into some Jewish texts and discover when it's prohibited, if and when it may be permitted, and as far as how it should manifest. Good evening, Eloise and Howard. Good evening. So we're just getting started. As far as how it should manifest, that we're not going to be addressing tonight. I may have once shared the story about the rabbi who was a very big proponent of educating children with a soft hand and with warmth, and he always preached about that and how important it is and critical it is. At one point in the synagogue, they raised some money and they were redoing and repaving the parking lot. And you know, once a parking lot is 100% finished, or a sidewalk, or anything cement-oriented, what do children love to do? You want to leave your mark on the world, right? So it may be your hand, or it may be something else, or your name. And there they were, messing around with the cement, and it was just completed, and it's all perfect. And the rabbi comes running out, and he's screaming at the kids, "You get away from here, you rascals. What are you doing damaging the synagogue's property?" And his wife overheard what's going on. And she approaches her husband, the rabbi, and says, "You know, my dear husband, I'm a little bit surprised at your reaction. I mean, usually you talk about needing to talk to kids with softness, and there you are, unleashing at them." And he said, "Look, I love children in the abstract, not in the concrete." So we're going to be speaking a little bit in the abstract tonight. Another important point before we jump in is, as noted, it's a very sensitive topic. It may have a lot of personal meaning. It may be personal to you. It may be personal to a friend or a relative. And it's a very difficult struggle for somebody to have to go through it. Just let me establish that there's no judgment here whatsoever about anybody relating to this topic. It's very complex. There's a lot of unique characteristics in each individual, and each situation is unique. Tonight we're going to be discussing general terms, and of course anybody who needed to deal with this, we view them and engage with them and with a lot of understanding, compassion, regardless of our stance on the question. So that said, we're going to jump in, and with that we will open up with our case study, as we've been doing in this course, and your attention to the screen.
Stissel is a highly popular multiple award-winning Israeli television series about a fictional family living in a fervently religious Jerusalem neighborhood. Two of its characters, who go by the stage names of Ruhami and Hanina, are depicted as a young couple. Ruhami becomes pregnant, but at 21 weeks, she is hospitalized for acute shortness of breath. Ruhami is informed that she has been diagnosed with pulmonary arterial hypertension, a rare disease, dangerously exaggerated by her pregnancy. She is told that to save her own life, the doctors must remove her baby, which will almost certainly not survive. But Ruhami would rather take her chances. Hanina does not want to lose his wife. Her life should take precedence, but Ruhami insists on choosing otherwise. Hanina reaches for his cell phone. Thankfully, that scene was simply an act. But how do you think a rabbi might respond to a similar, real-life drama? Does Jewish law support a mother's choice to voluntarily risk her life for the sake of offering her fetus a chance of survival?
Okay, so that's the question that this scenario, which of course comes from a movie. Anybody watch Shtisel here? No, I heard a lot about it. I never watched it myself, but there it is. So anyway, we saw the case. Ruhami's life is in danger, and she's being advised to terminate her pregnancy, and if she won't, they don't know if she will survive. And the question is, and we're on page 94, by the way, in our student books, if you had to offer a personal opinion, would you consider it morally acceptable for Ruhami to risk her own life for the sake of saving her unborn child? Is she allowed to take the approach of saying, I'm not going to terminate, even though it will risk my own life? Is she allowed to do that? Any opinions, please?
I would say yes.
She's allowed to make that choice.
She's young. She doesn't have any other children. Maybe it's quite possible she may survive this, even though it's very serious.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else?
For the sake of argument?
Yeah.
For the sake of argument, I would say no, because you're obligated to stop a RODEF, which maybe the baby's considered a RODEF.
Okay. Okay. Good point. Yes?
Not an opinion, just an observation. She may be putting two lives at risk by not having the baby delivered, both the baby and her own, one of which might be able to be saved.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else? All right. Okay, so we got some perspectives, some valuable perspectives, and now let's advance. So we're going to learn a little bit about Nick. Wanna just get the door? It's Dr. Ori Hample. He has actually missed the first two. Kobe thinks it's too quiet for there to be a class here, and yet he didn't ring the bell. So maybe just go open it. I appreciate it. Thank you. So, okay, there he is.
Tracy found the bell.
Okay, we'll just give him a half a minute. Give them both a half a minute to come back in. Welcome, welcome. Thank you for joining. We're just launching in. So we just watched a short video which presented the case study for our discussion today, and the question that remains is what we see on the screen. The story was of a woman who was pregnant. She was told that she needs to terminate her pregnancy, and if she doesn't, her own life would be at risk. And in that case study, she decided she wants to not terminate and better let her life be at risk. The question is, can a mother risk her own life for the sake of saving her unborn child? We're on page 90. We were on page 94 or 6? 94. That's where we presented the case and our question. And now we will proceed on page 98. So we're going to start studying some Talmudic sources about, as we're calling it here, Talmudic embryology. So we're going to start learning. We're going to read text number 1. Nick, are you okay with reading text number 1?
Sure, Rabbi.
Please, this is a quote from the Talmud, Tractate Nida. Go ahead.
A fetus inside its mother's womb resembles a folded writing table. Its two hands rest on its temples, its two elbows rest on its knees, its heels rest against its buttocks, and its head lies between its knees. Its mouth is closed and its navel is open. It eats what its mother eats, drinks what its mother drinks, and produces no excrement. A lamp burns above its head, and it sees from one end of the world to the other. The fetus is taught the entire Torah. However, as the fetus emerges into the world, an angel approaches and strikes its mouth, causing it to forget the entire Torah. The fetus does not emerge before it is made to take an oath. What is the content of the oath? Be righteous and do not wicked.
Okay, so thank you for that reading. I would love to hear from you. Does this passage shed any light on whether a fetus should be considered a human life?
Well, it's thinking. It's learning.
It's thinking, it's learning. Okay,
it's
anybody
present,
else?
It's whole.
Okay. Any other reactions? Just this text on its own, does it shed any light on whether a fetus should be considered a human life? There's no wrong answer, whatever you're thinking. Okay, all we have is Nick. So,
it's a being.
What's that?
It's a being.
It's a being, okay. Anybody going to argue? Come on, a little bit of excitement. We were counting on some controversial discussions tonight. Okay, so let's zoom in a little bit. There are three curious points in this kind of cryptic passage. Okay, number one, we said that a lamp burns above the fetus's head, taught the entire Torah, and the fetus is made to make an oath. What's the meaning of these three things? So for starters, when we say a lamp burns above its head, what do you think that means? What is a fire represent?
Purity.
Anybody else?
I think it's like the burning bush. Like
burning bush? Light. What about a candle in general?
Oh, light. Or
oh, spark, yeah.
Okay, relating to a person more specifically?
A soul.
We have a well-known verse, Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. The soul of man is a candle of God, which is why we light candles. We memorialize with candles because a candle represents the soul. So this teaching, like many others in the agadic genre of the Talmud, is more of an allegory or a parable. A fire burning above the head of the fetus obviously does not mean an actual fire, but it could refer to the soul. So we see that there's an association of a human soul to this fetus. That's number one. Number two, the fetus is taught the entire Torah. So what's happening? Just like during gestation, during this period, so the body of the fetus develops and matures so it can get ready to enter the universe and live outside the womb. So on a spiritual level as well, the time of gestation is a time for the fetus to be prepared spiritually so that it can live a productive spiritual life once it emerges from the womb, which is why it's taught the Torah. But what does it mean that it's taught the Torah at that phase? So, of course, it needs proper training. Like anyone who needs training to prepare for something, a human being also does, and the soul also does. And this is why this soul is taught the Torah. But we also said that it's made to forget the Torah. So what's the point?
Sure.
Just to learn it and then forget it. But there's a reason for it. Even though the soul is forgetting the Torah, it's still learning the Torah so that when the soul with the body emerges onto the scene, onto the world scene, and then begins to grow up and starts to learn Torah, then what it learns, it's not going to be hearing for the first time. It's not foreign. It's going to come more naturally to us because it's not the first time we're encountering it. Can anybody resonate with the fact that sometimes you hear a song, you can't quite put your finger on it, where you heard it, and you don't really know the song, but you feel like you heard it once. Like it's resonating. You recognize it from some place, somewhere, at some time. No? Anyone relate?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So similarly, the purpose of learning the Torah in the womb, forgetting it, for what's in it? Why bother? Because later on, when we do study Torah and we do hear spiritual ideas, we should resonate with it, and it should come more naturally and be comfortable with it, and it shouldn't be like the first time we're hearing these ideas.
This applies to Jewish souls.
Torah does apply to Jewish souls only, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Torah and its commandments are only commanded to Jewish souls. So, number three, the fetus does not emerge before it is made to take an oath. So if anyone ever studied Tanya, the opening, the second line in the very opening has this statement actually. Also comes from the Talmud that, as we said, every soul before it enters the world is made to take an oath that it's going to live a righteous life. So first of all, it's taking an oath. It's a serious thing. But the word for oath is, over there, is mashbiim, like from the word shvu'ah, which also has another meaning. The word sava, with a sin, or masbia, we say it in Birkat HaMazon, umasbia, l'chol chai ratzon. What does that mean?
To satiate.
So this oath is not just that the soul takes an oath. The soul is actually being satiated. It's being endowed with the strength and the abilities and the power that it will need to be able to live a righteous life once it's born into this world. So with this oath comes the tools to be able to cope within this physical world. All that is happening while the soul is still in the status of being a fetus. So bottom line is, what's the perspective that we can glean from this Talmudic passage that we read and we just analyzed a little bit? That we should not look at a fetus as just a lump of flesh or a cluster of cells. It's not that. It comprises a body and a soul, because there's already discussion about that fire, about it teaching Torah to the soul. So there's a soul involved. That's clear. Even beyond just that there's a soul involved, it's actually preparing for its mission. It's preparing during that phase for what's going to come after. So obviously it's getting ready for a very important mission. When do you prepare for something? When we're getting ready for something important, we prepare. So the soul also is preparing during gestation for the very important mission that it's taking on once it is born into this world. Okay, so accordingly, well, one more thought on this. When it comes to, let's say, a couple thinking about if they should have a child, so at the point of them having this conversation, they can decide yes, they could decide no, theoretically, maybe another child or whatever. In other words, there's a possibility of yes or no. Once a child is born, then the parents can't imagine life without this child. Then it's so absolute that you can't even believe that you were considering if you should or shouldn't have. I'm speaking generally, of course. There's always exceptions. What does that tell us? When it comes to God, we know that time doesn't really exist within the heavenly realm, certainly not within God's own realm. God is not limited by time. In fact, the very name of God that we say in Hebrew and the spelling of it, the word itself means that past, present, and future are all one to God. So for us, the present is not the future. We have to experience the future in order to appreciate that we can't live without this child. As far as God's concerned, the past, present, and future are all collapsed into one. So as far as God is concerned, this fetus is already, it's already in existence. So for God, the future that this fetus holds, God sees it already in present tense while it's still a fetus. We have to wait in order to see what's going to materialize. For God, potential and actual are one and the same. If that's the case, then we can appreciate even more, certainly from God's perspective, that the present and the future are one, and therefore there is a tremendous value in a life even before it is born. So based on what we discussed so far, we would say that aborting a fetus is certainly no simple matter because of everything that we just said. At the same time, we're gonna revisit this same passage that we just discussed, studied, and analyzed. And we're gonna analyze it a little further. And that is that even though we are concluding that a fetus has tremendous value, and it's certainly not a simple matter to abort a fetus, at the same time, by looking at the same passage, we also have an indication that while it's of value, it's not quite equal to a complete human being. In other words, as every rabbi will say, on the other hand, the same teaching, what does it mean that a lamp burns above his head? So yeah, we did say that a soul is associated with this fetus, but the lamp burning above its head also means that this soul is not integrated into this fetus like it is by a full-fledged human being. When we're born into this world, so with the process of life, I'm not going to get into the details right now, it's not relevant, but as we continue through our life, especially up until Bar and Bat Mitzvah, our soul integrates into our body more and more until it's completed at Bar and Bat Mitzvah, which is why we celebrate. But like I said, that's for a different day. Point is that actual life of a human being is about soul and body integrating with each other. But this fetus, even though there's a soul associated with it, it's not integrated. It's above its head. It's not within. That means that while it's there, and it's certainly contributing to this, to the fetus, even at this stage, but it isn't quite the same as a human life. That's number one. Number two, another important factor, as we said in the Talmudic teaching before, while the fetus is a fetus, it eats and drinks what its mother does. In other words, it's not doing anything independently. It's taught the entire Torah. Okay, both of these things are important. It's being provided for 100% by the mother, and it's being taught Torah. It doesn't say it studies Torah. Studies would mean that it's doing something on its own. When we're just taught something exclusively, it means that we're not investing effort. It's just coming to us from the outside. And this is significant because what a very important component and factor about a human life is the fact that it has independence. And that is really the whole value of being born. What does birth even mean? Why are we celebrating at the time of birth? At birth? Because at that moment, even though this fetus, a day before was born and right after it's born, it's basically the same. It's not any different than it was one day ago. The only difference is that now it was born, yesterday it wasn't. But what does that mean? That suddenly now it takes on independence. Yesterday it didn't do anything on its own, now it does. Now it has to swallow on its own, and now it begins to do things on its own, it breathes on its own. It's not reliant anymore, it's not just attached to its mother, it now has its own independence. And even forgetting the Torah, is preparing for its independence. Because now, when it will be able to, of course, it will study on its own. So that's what defines birth and afterbirth, that now it's independent before it wasn't. So because of these two deficiencies in the fetal state, number one, the soul is not integrated. It's there, but not integrated. Number two, it doesn't have any independence while it's still a fetus. So because of both of these things, birth is a joyous occasion, because the child, the baby, wins its independence at this moment, and of course the soul begins to integrate into the body. So what we just did so far was we brought up this Talmudic teaching: a lamp burns above its head, the fetus is taught the entire Torah, and the fetus does not emerge before it is made to take an oath. So on one hand, we said that this tells us that there's value to the fetus because it has a soul and it's taught Torah, etc. On the other hand, we're also saying at the same time that the soul is only above its head, which means that the body and soul are still separate, and the fetus doesn't do anything independently, and this is why there is so much joy associated with birth, because upon entering the world, a baby demonstrates a fundamental aspect of humanity, and that is independence. So it is, and it also isn't. It is obviously extremely valuable, there's a soul involved, but it's not quite like, it's not quite on par with a human being, which already does have independence and the soul begins to integrate.
But a newborn is fully dependent for survival. It doesn't do anything for itself.
It's true that it's still dependent, but independence begins, let's just say. Up until then, it's 100%, and now, yes, it still needs its mother, most certainly for a while. But at least there's the first glimpses of independence actually start then. Any quick comments or observations or objections? Okay. Everyone ready? Okay, let's advance. So we're on page 100 now, and we're going to study and analyze the following text. We're going to bring up a couple of verses from the book of Exodus. We're going to study them and analyze them as Talmudic scholars only do, and we're going to have some fun with them, and then we're going to discover some different approaches, and we'll try to understand the logic behind them. And from there, we'll get to appreciate the various different perspectives that we will decipher and that will emerge from there. So, we're going to start with text number 2. I'll ask Jacob to please read these verses in English.
If men are embroiled in an altercation, and a blow lands on a pregnant woman, and her fetuses emerge, and there is no tragedy, the perpetrator must certainly be punished, through providing restitution in accordance with the judge's orders. If, however, there is a tragedy, you must provide a life for a life.
Thank you. So, we're gonna try to analyze these verses a little bit. Join me, please, on page 101, in exercise 3.2. Okay, I'm going to ask you to please get involved in the discussion a little bit. So, number one, question number one, what is the meaning of the phrase, and we're going to quote from these verses, so what's the meaning of the phrase, her fetuses emerge and there is no tragedy? What does that mean? And I'm going to ask you if you think it's A or B. Do you think it's A, the fetuses and mother survive? Is that what you think it is?
Yes.
So everyone thinks it's A, or B, the mother survives but the fetuses die. So it seems like everyone... Anyone for B or no?
A.
A. Everyone's A. Okay, so that was her fetuses emerge and there is no tragedy. Now, the next quote from the verse is, the perpetrator must certainly be punished through providing restitution. What is the basis for this restitution? What are they compensating for? A, provoking a premature but healthy birth, or B, causing the death of the fetuses? Raise your hand if you think it's A. Okay, anyone, any B or no? Seems like all A's. Okay, let's continue to the third quote. What's the meaning of the phrase, if there is a tragedy, you must provide a life for a life? Is it A, if the fetuses die, the assailant receives the death penalty? Or B, if the mother dies, the assailant receives a death penalty? Raise your hand if you think it's A.
It's a trick question, Rabbi.
I think it's both.
Or if you think it's B.
I think it's both. Yeah.
You think it's both.
I don't think that it makes a difference. Yeah. If either die.
So, by the way, it's very significant to say that if somebody kills the fetus, they have to pay with their life. A life for a life applies to the fetus. That means you're making the fetus a 1,000% life. Just noting that.
Understood.
Okay, so what's really happening here is, so of course in the first two questions we basically got A, and in the third question there were a lot more B's, if not all. The truth is that we have to choose A's or B's. If you choose A in one, you have to, it's got to be A throughout, and let's take a look at that again. So one way to read these verses and understand them is only with the A's, and that is that her fetuses emerge and there is no tragedy. So let's take the A approach. The fetuses and mother survive. They both survive. The next words, what does that mean? The perpetrator must certainly be punished. Well, if they both survived, what's he being punished for? So it's A, because provoking a premature but healthy birth. That's the only thing that happened here, was an early birth. And then the verse says, if there is a tragedy, you must provide a life for a life. That's referring to the fetuses. If the fetuses die, the assailant receives the death penalty. This is one way of understanding these verses. And I'm not going to get into it much, but there's other religions and the church or whatever, and this is actually how they understand these verses. They understand it, that it's talking about the fetus, as far as the tragedy, and they have to, you must provide a life for a life. However, the sages of Judaism read these verses differently, and in their view, it's B, B, and B. So her fetuses emerge, and there is no tragedy. What does that mean? It means that the mother survives, but the fetuses die. Okay, so there is no tragedy refers to the mother. Next quote, the perpetrator must certainly be punished through providing restitution. What's the basis for this restitution? Causing the death of the fetuses. That's what happened. So there is no tragedy to the mother. The fetuses, yes, did die. And that's what you have to pay restitution for. Third quote, if there is a tragedy, you must provide a life for a life. What does B say? However, if the mother dies, the assailant receives a death penalty. So, this is very significant. And let's just look at the screen again so we can appreciate it a little bit more. So we have option A and option B. Option A, if you want to take the approach that a fetus is identical to a human life, if the fetuses were lost, the attacker would be liable for the death penalty. Option B, where the fetus is not exactly equal to a human life, if the fetuses were lost, the attacker would not be liable for the death penalty. And as well, when the fetuses are not the same as human life, that would not be liable to the death penalty. Okay, we established that. So these are the two ways of reading it, A versus B. And the sages of Judaism read these verses and had a tradition that we read these verses with the B approach. So what does that tell us? So if you follow A, then you have a very hardline position against abortion. But the Jewish tradition understands these verses as B, as we said, that if the fetuses are lost, but the mother is fine, there's no life for a life, it's only compensation, meaning something did happen here, some damage was done, and for that the assailant needs to pay. And what do we conclude from this is that in Judaism, a fetus is not equal to a human being, to a human life. And therefore, it's not the same liability. If it would have been the mother, it would be life for a life. Because it's the fetus, it's not. There is compensation involved, but it's not quite equal. Okay? Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. On the other hand... On the other hand, yes, we just did say and we just did conclude from these verses and the way we understand them that a fetus is not exactly like a human life. But on the other hand, the fetus should not be regarded lightly at all. And where do we see this? In the next quotes from the Talmud. So in text number 3, we're going to kind of balance out what we just studied from those verses, where we said it's not quite like a human life, but this is going to tell us a little bit of a different story. Joyce, if you're okay with reading text 3, please, from the Talmud.
If on Shabbat a woman sitting on a birth stool dies before she was able to deliver her child, they should fetch a knife and cut open her womb to extract the child. The Talmud objects, but that statement is obvious. There is no prohibition against cutting flesh on Shabbat. Rabbah responded, the statement is necessary to permit the fetching of the knife by the way of a public thoroughfare, which is prohibited on Shabbat.
Okay. So, the same fetus that we just said is not exactly equal to a complete human being. What happens if the fetus is in danger on Shabbat? You violate Shabbat to save the fetus. Now, generally speaking, we know that we only violate Shabbat to save a life. Anything else, even other situations, we don't. Now, one of the ways of observing Shabbat is that we don't carry things from one domain to another domain. So if I'm walking from my house to shul on Shabbat, my pockets will be empty. I won't be carrying any prayer books or my talit. It's all going to be here in advance because you can't move things from one place to another. What are we saying here? That even if you need to transfer a knife for this purpose to save the fetus, then you absolutely violate Shabbat. Now you only violate Shabbat to save a life. What does that tell you about the fetus?
It's a life.
That it's a life. So here we have another source that's telling us, that's adding a lot more weight to it. Before we said it's not quite a life, now we're saying, well, it kind of is a life. So it's true that a fetus is not exactly like a complete human life. Nonetheless, text number 3, the second Talmudic teaching about violating Shabbat does tell us that to kill a fetus is prohibited because you violate Shabbat in order to save it. That means it's a life. That means you don't just go about aborting a pregnancy just because. So it's a very serious thing. And the proof for that is that you even violate Shabbat on its behalf. That means it's very serious. Okay, so we're good. So we have two perspectives here. One from those verses, the second from this Talmudic teaching about Shabbat observance. Okay? Anything need to be clarified? All right. So, we just established that we violate Shabbat to save the fetus, which means that it's very serious and it's a life. We didn't say exactly what it is or define exactly what it is, but it's clear that it's a life because you only violate Shabbat to save a life. So it's a life. And therefore, abortion is very serious and you don't just terminate pregnancies. The question is, are there any exceptions? So we just established that you don't terminate pregnancies. The question is, are there any exceptions to this rule? Maybe there's a scenario that it's necessary. So to find out, we're going to turn our attention to a Mishnah. Let's read text number 4, Ori, please.
If a woman experiences life-threatening difficulties during labor, we cut the fetus in her womb, and extracted limb by limb, because her life takes precedence over the fetus's life.
Okay. So what's happening here? A woman is giving birth, so obviously we're talking basically at full term, but she is her life is at stake. Her life is being threatened as she's giving birth. The only way to save her life would be to take the life of the fetus. What do? Teaches the Mishnah that you do whatever necessary and you terminate the pregnancy and thereby saving the life of the mother. This is the Mishnah giving this teaching. And now obviously if there's a way to figure it out to save both, then you do that. This Mishnah rules that even at this late stage, we're talking about she's giving birth, it's a late stage of gestation, the fetus is aborted if it's threatening the life of the mother. So now, we have this Mishnah. Now, Mishnah is more authoritative than Talmud, if you may be familiar, but just in case you aren't, Talmud is like a commentary on the Mishnah. So Mishnah was compiled roughly 1900 years ago, and the Talmud was published roughly 1500 years ago. So the Mishnah is a very authoritative teaching, and the Talmud analyzes the Mishnah. So over here we just taught a Mishnah that you do what's necessary to save the mother's life. Now, how do we understand this Mishnah? What's the implication of this teaching? For that, we're going to introduce two commentaries. They may both be familiar to you. One is Rashi, who is basically the number one commentator on Torah and Talmud. His commentary is always printed together with the Torah or the Talmud. And we are also going to quote Rambam, known as Maimonides, who was also a doctor, by the way. So we're going to hear two different perspectives from Rashi and Rambam. I'm going to say Rambam from Maimonides, by the way, if that's okay. So Rashi and Rambam, we're going to hear what they each have to say and how they analyze and understand this Mishnah, which just taught us that if the mother's life is in danger, then you terminate the pregnancy to save the mother. So first with Rashi. Lauren, would you read text 5, please?
A midwife reaches into the womb with her hand to dismember the fetus and extract it limb by limb. For as long as a fetus has not emerged into the world, it is not alive. It is therefore permitted to kill it for the sake of saving the mother's life.
Very, very big words here from Rashi. And he states very clearly, why does this Mishnah teach what it does? As long as a fetus has not emerged into the world, it is not a life. We're talking moments before it emerges into the world. Rashi is saying that it's not a life. It's therefore permitted to kill it for the sake of saving the mother's life. This is Rashi. But then we have a teaching from Rambam in text number 6. Helen, if you could please read that for us.
We are commanded to not take pity on the life of a Rodef, a murderous pursuer, if that is necessary to rescue the intended victim. On this basis, our sages ruled that if a woman experiences life-threatening complications during labor, it is permitted to abort the fetus in her womb with drugs or with an instrument, for the fetus is considered a form of Rodef against its mother.
Thank you. So here Rambam is introducing a very big idea as well. Let's compare and contrast these two texts. So difference number one between Rashi and Maimonides is that Rashi says point blank, the fetus in the womb is not a life. In Hebrew, lav nefeshu, very big words. Maimonides, no mention of the life status of the fetus. He doesn't say it's a life or it's not a life. He doesn't make mention of it. Rashi states that it's not a life, and therefore, the mother's life takes precedence, and you do what you need to do to save the mother. Maimonides doesn't say that. What does he say? So, on the other hand, Maimonides says the fetus is considered a rodef. We'll talk about that in a second. Rashi, no mention of the principle of a rodef. Now, what is a rodef? And Jacob mentioned it before. So, it goes like this. A rodef literally means a pursuer. If somebody is pursuing somebody else with a gun, Jewish law says that you have to save this potential victim, the person who is going to be shot momentarily. If I do nothing, I have to do whatever I can to save that person's life, even if it means taking the life of the pursuer, known in Hebrew as the rodef. Rodef means chasing or pursuing. So, just to use a very obvious example, right now Israel has an obligation to destroy Hamas. It's not just it's not political. It's not whatever. It's an obligation. If you're Jewish, you have an obligation to remove a threat 100% till it isn't a threat anymore. And a rodef is exactly that. When person A is pursuing person B. So why is that? So this is what Rambam invoked, the rodef principle. So let's just appreciate Rashi versus Rambam a little bit more. So Rashi says the reason why you terminate the pregnancy to save the mother's life, he doesn't mention rodef, but he does say because the fetus is not a life. He says that point blank. In other words, it's certainly sacred, it should be cherished because of the potential that the fetus has, but, and that's why, of course, typically it's forbidden to abort. Rashi would never say that you could just abort without a very, very good reason. Over here, to save the life of the mother, he'll say that you do, because it doesn't have the status of a life. In other words, even Rashi would say that abortion is murder, but not when the mother's life is in danger. When that's what's happening, then that's not what it is anymore, because you're saving the mother. Let me clarify that. I mixed Rambam in a drop. According to Rashi, first, abortion would not be considered murder. And that's why, when the mother's life is at stake, that's what's done. If it would be considered murder, he actually wouldn't be able to say that, because then you would have two lives. And why would one take precedence over the other? So Rashi says it's not murder. However, when it comes to the Rambam, so he doesn't say the status of the fetus at all, but he does say, as we said, that he says that that the fetus falls into the category of rodef. In other words, it's not just what the Rambam is implying. What he's implying by saying what he does say, that it's not just a sacred entity that has potential. In his view, a fetus in utero is granted some sort of life status. He's not going to say it's identical to a full-blown human life, but it's not just potential. It's not just cherished for what it is or what it will be in the future. It actually has the status of a life. Yes, not full, but a life, yes. Unlike Rashi. Rashi said it's not a life. Rambam, Maimonides, is saying that it is a life. Now, you can't... So if that's the case, you're going to ask Maimonides, you're not saying the fetus is not a life. You say it is. Even if it's not identical to the mother, it's a life. So how do you understand that Mishnah that says that you terminate the pregnancy in order to save the mother's life? When do you ever take one life to save another life? We never heard of that. In fact, the Talmud teaches elsewhere that if somebody approaches somebody and says, go kill that person over there, and if you don't, I'm going to kill you. What are you supposed to do? You cannot go take someone else's life to save your own. Because, as the Talmud says, why is one person's blood redder than the other? So you can't take one life to save another life. If that's the case, you ask Rambam, if he says that the fetus is a life, how are you able to take it to save the mother? And this is why he invokes the concept or status of rodef. Rodef means that, yes, the fetus is a life, but right now it's considered a pursuer. It's like pursuing the life of the mother, because the mother's life is now in danger because of the fetus. So the fetus being a rodef, you do whatever you can to save the potential victim, which is the mother, even if it means to take the life of the rodef, of the pursuer. In this case, that is the fetus. Good? All right. So let's just make sure we have this all good. Why does the mother's life override that of the fetuses? So we have Rashi who says the fetus is not yet a life. That's why the mother takes precedence. Maimonides says the fetus is pursuing its mother. And therefore, you do whatever you can to save the mother, which is the almost victim. Okay, so we said that both reading that Mishnah about the mother about to give birth and you terminate the pregnancy, Rashi and Rambam both agree. They don't argue with the Mishnah. They, as we said, the Mishnah has the authority and it says what it says. And they'll both say that you terminate the pregnancy. The question is just why, on what basis, what's the logic? To Rashi, it's not a life. To Rambam, it's a pursuer, it's a rodef. So it's just about the logic behind why you would terminate. The question is, over there they agree about the result. They differ on the logic. So what would be a scenario where they would actually differ on what you do? Not just what the logic behind it is, but is there a scenario when Rashi will say one thing and Rambam will say something else?
If the baby's born or not born, correct?
As a fetus. So, is there a scenario that Rashi would differ from Rambam as far as what you actually do?
I think so.
In other words, what's the difference if I say that you terminate the pregnancy because it's not a life, or I say that you terminate because it's a rodef? Is it just
arbitrary?
Yeah. What?
The health of the fetus.
The health of the fetus. Yes, very good point. So, let's advance into this. So because they don't view abortion with the same level with the same level severity, so there will be scenarios where they won't fall in the same place. And one such practical difference would be a case, as Lauren mentioned, when the fetus was diagnosed with a severe genetic disease, let's just say. So take, for example, let's just say Tay-Sachs. So, generally speaking, a fetus diagnosed with Tay-Sachs usually won't live past like 3 years old and will be a very torturous life up until then. So the question is, if it was diagnosed in utero, and they know what's coming, what are they allowed to do? What does Jewish law say? What's the spectrum that you're allowed to do during pregnancy when the diagnosis was something like this? So according to Rambam, what did Rambam say? The fetus is a life. In the earlier scenario, he said that you could only terminate because the fetus is a rodef. It's like it's threatening the mother's life. But this fetus, which is diagnosed with Tay-Sachs, as tragic as that is, it's not threatening the life of the mother. The mother is okay and will be okay as far as the pregnancy is concerned. So the Rambam will say that there's no justification to terminate the pregnancy because even though it's tragic, because there's no rodef. So that's what Rambam would say. Rashi maybe would have more room for leniency because, as we said, he said you terminate because it isn't a life. So maybe there's more room to be lenient with Rashi. So let's see how modern day halachic authorities dealt with situations like this. So we mentioned in both previous lessons already, we mentioned Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. So he actually is more strict and follows Rambam when it comes to abortion. And he actually applies it to the question of Pesach. So he actually received the question, as we'll see in text number 7. He received a question about a pregnancy with such a diagnosis. And the question was, what are they allowed to do? Let's see what he answered in this scenario. Eloise, are you okay reading text number 7, please? Thank you very much. So, Rabbi Feinstein will say that in a scenario of Tay-Sachs, abortion may not be permitted because he relies on Rambam, who will say that if the mother's life is not actively endangered, then there's no room for it. And of course, he concludes by saying to put your faith in God, and it's all in God's hands. Now, what about in Rashi's view? So Rashi, who said that it's not a life, then abortion is not murder, and it's only considered a life in potential, then it could be, there would be more room to be lenient in a scenario of Tay-Sachs. Now, even though the mother's life is not in danger, but there are other issues, even though she's not physically in danger, but the experience of giving birth to such a child and the few years of anguish that will follow, and God forbid losing the child, all of that would be indescribable suffering. So the question is, if the psychological burden, the emotional burden that the parents would be carrying in such a situation, is that severe enough to justify terminating in Rashi's view? So as a result, another more recent halachic authority, who we also mentioned in both of last classes on different topics, Rabbi Waldenberg, he actually relies more on Rashi's position that abortion is not murder. And he ruled that one can abort a child with Tay-Sachs if the parents desire this. Let's read his text. Howard, number 8, please.
You inquired about the possibility of abortion in a case of Tay-Sachs disease, which can be diagnosed during pregnancy. The consequences of this disease are extremely severe and untreatable. And you ask whether this constitutes sufficient grounds to permit an abortion. After carefully considering all aspects of this issue, my conclusion is that in this unique case, where the consequences of continuing the pregnancy and bringing the child to term are so severe, it is possible to permit an abortion before the fetus reaches 7 months. I base this conclusion on a lengthy halachic analysis of the status of abortion that I published in, I can't pronounce that, 9-551, which presents the conclusion that abortion does not constitute an act of murder. After 7 months, abortion is a far weightier decision because at that stage, the fetus typically attains a state of viability.
Thank you. So Rabbi Waldenberg, he takes the approach of Rashi that and says that even though abortion is forbidden under regular circumstances, but it's not considered murder. And as a result, in a scenario like this, where there's a diagnosis of Tay-Sachs or similar, where the baby will have a short and painful life and will bring tremendous pain and suffering for the parents, he rules that it is permitted, but he says that he's more comfortable with it up until the point of viability. He uses 7 months, but he himself says, by the way, that he just came up with that time. It's his own assumption. He didn't get that number from any earlier source. So that is what, let's just take a look at the screen to kind of clarify what's going on here. So first we talked about Rabbi Feinstein, who is more on the Maimonides side of things, and he says that a Tay-Sachs abortion may not be permitted, and that's because abortion is equivalent to murder, relying on Maimonides that the fetus is a life. However, Rabbi Waldenberg takes the approach that Tay-Sachs abortion may be permitted because he relies on Rashi that abortion is typically forbidden but not as a form of murder. And therefore, in extenuating circumstances, there may be room to permit it. All good? Okay. Just by the way, as an aside, if I know we don't always pay attention to which rabbi is saying what in each class, but you may happen to recall that last week when we talked about end-of-life issues, Rabbi Feinstein and Waldenberg actually had differing positions. Last week, Rabbi Waldenberg was much more strict about end-of-life, and he said you can't do anything to end the life. Rabbi Feinstein was more lenient, if you recall. And he gave more room to not give treatments, etc. Over here, it's the other way around. Here, Rabbi Feinstein is much more, let's just say, pro-life. Rabbi Feinstein is more pro-life, and much more strict, versus Rabbi Waldenberg, who is giving more room for leniency. What does that tell you? It's insightful for the halachic process. A rabbi doesn't have some preconceived notion that he comes and applies to every single situation the same way. You see, both of them studied these two different areas and came to opposite conclusions. That means they come and with objectivity, they study what's before them, even if it may bring them to a different conclusion that they were at in a different in another scenario. Okay. So, where do other halachic authorities nowadays stand? So many of them follow the more stricter approach, like Maimonides, that it would be considered murder. However, every specific case needs to be brought individually to an expert rabbi, and I'm emphasizing this in every one of these classes because ultimately these issues are all unique, every circumstance is different, and always the specifics need to be taken into consideration of what is of what's unique to that case, and it's always very important to bring it to an expert at that time. So, for example, and that's why it's important to bring it to a rabbi, an expert rabbi, because many rabbis will be inclined to leniency during earlier stages of pregnancy. So even if somebody generally follows Maimonides and says that it's a life and says that it's murder, but in an early stage may rely on Rashi when necessary. There is... There is a, you know what, it's kind of going off topic, but we'll read text number 9 just because it gives us the basis for an understanding of the concept of 40 days. In the Talmud, 40 days into a pregnancy is a defining time. Nick, would you like to read that? I'm not going to dwell on the context of where it's discussed. We're just going to extract what's important for our discussion. Number nine, please, Nick.
If a daughter of a Kohen married a non-Kohen and he died on the wedding night, she may immerse in the mikveh and eat teruma that evening. Why are we not concerned that she may be pregnant? Rav Chisda said she may eat teruma until 40 days from her marriage, because if she is not pregnant, there is no disqualifying factor. And if she is pregnant until 40 days have elapsed, the embryo is mere fluid.
Thank you. So, like I said, it's a complex context of halacha, of when somebody could eat sacred food or not. What's important to extract from that discussion is just that the Talmud gives 40 days as a milestone of when the pregnancy goes from being referred to as mere fluid into something more substantial. So up until 40 days, you will have certain halachic authorities that will be much more lenient because of this this status that the Talmud gives to that. To that turning point. So nowadays, let's just say when it comes to like a Tay-Sachs scenario, so authorities may be much more lenient before 40 days. The problem is that the tests usually don't even happen to until around like right after that time. Typically, they're not done by 40 days. Just by the way, 40 days in Jewish law is. The 40 days start at conception. In medical terms, they start counting from the beginning of the last menstrual cycle. So 40 days in Jewish law will already be like 54 days as far as medical terms are concerned. Just by the way, so you all know when life actually starts in a Jewish home, right?
Yeah, on graduation from medical school.
Exactly. Just wanted to make sure we all knew that. So, just by the way, in religious communities... in religious communities, just by the way, because of these Tay-Sachs diseases and similar, which are more common within Ashkenazi Jews. So in religious communities, at least the New York area, an organization started, I don't know how long ago, maybe 30, 40 years ago. It's called Dor Yesharim. Literally it means upright generations. And what they do is, basically, sometimes they go to yeshivas and girls' seminaries, or other times you just have to go in and get, like, a blood test. And they basically keep, like, a bank of... So they test you to see if you're a carrier of Tay-Sachs and similar, a bunch of things. And they keep this information. They don't even tell you if you are or not. They just keep your information and your record, and before you want to start dating a girl, now the assumption is that the girl also did the same thing. So they have records for whatever, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, certainly by now. Before I started dating my wife, each of us respectively called up Dor Yesharim and said, I want to give you my number and another number, and they'll take the numbers and they'll get back to you whatever a day or two later and let you know if these two are compatible or not. And you'll be told this before you even meet for the first time, and if you're told not compatible, then you just drop it and you don't even pursue it because of the risks involved.
It's very smart.
Mm-hmm. And
it's just easier to marry a Spartan.
Then maybe you don't have to do Dor Yesharim. there's no question that this was transformative as far as saving scenarios, tragic scenarios that could have been otherwise.
But they won't say like okay, you're compatible, but one of you is a carrier, they won't go that far?
No. Because if one is and one isn't, then you're compatible. They won't say anything. They'll just say either yes or no.
Yeah, but that has implications for the next generation, because they've already done a test.
Well, they also have to do Dor Yasharin. Okay.
So can you again say what the significance of the 40 days is?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's in the context of basically if somebody marries into a family who are Kohanes, then even if she doesn't come from a Kohen family, she's still allowed, she eats sacred food on her husband's behalf, even though she isn't a Kohen. Now, the scenario was, what if they got married and consummated the marriage and somehow, like, the next day he died? So, could she still eat teruma, as it's called, or not? So, it depends on if she's pregnant or not, and again, that context doesn't matter here. The point is, the Talmud makes a statement that up until 40 days, it's just mere fluid. After 40 days, then it becomes more of a substantial pregnancy. Okay. All right, let's proceed to the finale here. So we're going to revisit our case study that we opened with. The case study presented a case where continuing the pregnancy was a risk to the life of the mother. And in her case, taken from Shtisel, her name was Ruchami, and in her case, she wished to take her chances and continue with the pregnancy. The question we asked then was, is it allowed? Is she allowed to choose to continue with the pregnancy, even though her life is at risk? Basically, is she allowed to terminate the pregnancy, or is there a mandate that she terminates the pregnancy? That was the question. The question is she obligated to do so? So, any opinions? What would you say, based on what we know?
I think some of that has to do with the level of risk. So if the woman's life is not just we're worried about you, but this pregnancy will kill you, I think that's a very different perspective than, well, it might be dangerous and we want you to be aware that it might be dangerous and you need to consider whether or not you want to carry this baby to term. I think
you're so on target that we're going to ask you to read text number 10.
Okay.
And that's of Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, actually still alive and well. Looks like he's 98 years old, born in 1926, born in London, but lives in Jerusalem today. And let's see what he says about a scenario like this that was brought to his attention.
When the doctors are not clear about the degree of danger the pregnancy poses to the mother, and the risk appears to be at a level of 50% or less, we rule that the abortion is allowed. However, if the mother insists that she does not want to proceed with an abortion and instead wishes to rely on God's mercy and kindness, we cannot stand in her way, she may choose such an approach. For there is room to argue that Maimonides would only permit abortion when the fetus is clearly a rodent that threatens its mother's life. Although we do not follow that position, nevertheless, if a mother insists on acting in accordance with this position, we cannot prevent her. She may choose to rely on God's mercy and kindness. By contrast, when the doctors state that the danger is clear and the mother's chances of survival are minimal, it is then forbidden for the mother to choose to be lenient about her own life and place herself in such serious danger. In such a scenario, we unequivocally instruct her that she is halakhically obligated to undergo an abortion and that she may not endanger herself.
Thank you very much. So what do we see here? That when there is a danger to the mother, yes, she's allowed to terminate, but we don't yet say that she has to. When the risk is below 50%. But if it's more than that, and it's very clear, as you said, that the danger to her life is not really debatable, then she actually will have the obligation to terminate, and she won't be able to not do so. So it depends if it's less or more than 50%, if it's just recommended, or if it's actually obligatory. The bottom line is this, and this should be...
Wait.
Yes.
It said, if it's less than 50%, it's permitted. If it's more than 50%, and she insists it's permitted, but if it's like 100%, then it's not permitted.
If
abortion is obligatory, if it's a clear danger, not greater than 50% danger.
But the definition of clear, as far as Rabbi Sternbach is concerned, I think he puts it at more than 50%. What's that?
Anything more than 50%.
Right, that's what, because there's got to be some way to define clear versus...
I took clear as 100%.
Okay.
I think that's what clear means. No ambiguity.
Right. Let me just see what his words were. Yeah, he says if it's 50-50, that's what he says. Shahasafek shakul in Hebrew. Anyway, that's how he defines it. So, Jewish law, and this is very important to appreciate, that Jewish law doesn't, this concept of, as we discussed in previous classes, that it's my life, my choice, my body, my choice, and generally, in the secular world, that's the defining factor. But when it comes to Judaism and Jewish law, we established that this my life and autonomy isn't the beginning and end of everything, because in fact, we don't own our own life. Our life belongs to God, and we have obligations of what we need to do to look after our life. So therefore, when Jewish law is clear that the mother's life takes precedence, then it's not a choice. It's not a choice anymore. Remember, in our case study, if it's more than 50%, we're saying she's obligated to do it. So she loses her ability to make that choice as well, on that end, meaning she has to terminate. It's not even up to you anymore. Jewish law is mandating that you do so. So, of course, the gist of everything that we learned and the takeaway needs to be that Judaism sees life as sacred and the life of the fetus as sacred. Yes, it's valuable, it's a life, but it's not quite the same as the status of a full-blown human life. It certainly needs to be cherished, and it's certainly, we do not abort just because, but as we discussed, there are certainly exceptions, and of course, based on the halachic authority that one will approach, they may lean more with Rashi or more with Rambam, based on the extenuating circumstances. Just want to conclude with a couple of things. So first of all, I mentioned that organization called Dor Yesharim. So it's important to realize that in the religious communities in the larger cities, well, even here, the truth is, there's a lot of outstanding organizations that are there to assist mothers who are going through pregnancies, who give birth, even in wonderful circumstances, most certainly when there are struggles involved. There are organizations that deal with all types of things. Extremely robust, what they call chesed organizations in these communities that are there to support families and women who are going through pregnancies in general, especially when there are various different types of complications. In general, the religious communities stand out in this way tremendously. All the hospitals in the New York area, they all have what they call a Bikur Cholim room. Now, of course, over here in Houston, we have Eshel House, which is a tremendous resource for the Jewish community as far as lodging and kosher food, etc. In the New York area, within the hospitals, they'll always have a room stocked with kosher food for family members. I mean, I was there myself with, as I mentioned, with my father at Columbia, and there was a room there. And you know, if you ever got hungry, there was somewhere to go. But it's true in every area. So, just in conclusion, number one, two stories. First of all, my wife Esti's aunt. She has an aunt who is the Chabad Rebbetzin in Columbia, Maryland. Her name is Chani Baron, and she is a mother of, thank God, a large family. I don't know how many kids she has, but I think if I say 10, I'm either off by maybe one or two in one of the two directions. I'm probably underdoing it, but that's okay when it comes to these things. In any case, she was once pregnant, and she went to a routine doctor's visit, and she's in the waiting room. And there was another woman sitting nearby in the waiting room, and I'm quite sure that this woman was Jewish. I don't know if they necessarily knew each other before, but they started chatting, and my Esti's aunt shared with her how many kids she already has and what number this was and etc. and how much how energetic she was and how much she was anticipating and looking forward to having her next child, and very upbeat and very positive. And that was the conversation, and that's it. It was just it was a conversation that you wouldn't even think twice about. It's like an airplane conversation, and you move along. It wasn't until years later that the same woman told Chani Baron that, I want to remind you, do you remember that we once met in the waiting room when we were waiting for our doctor's appointments? And she says, yes. And she says, I just want to let you know that I came to see my doctor, to talk to the doctor about aborting my pregnancy. And after the conversation with you, and the positive attitude that you had and the anticipation and excitement that you had for having another child, I actually decided to not do it. And we were blessed with a child, and I have a tremendous gratitude to you for that. So that's just one story. In conclusion, one other story, which happened in Israel, quite well known. But basically, this was in Hebron, I believe, and long story short, I'm going to cut out a lot of details, but Hebron is a city where that's like 99% Arab, and the small Jewish community there has to be very vigilant and on guard. Bottom line is, there was a yeshiva student who was once shot by an Arab, and at first, nobody really heard it because it was just like one shot, and these things aren't so, But anyway, eventually there were soldiers who were protecting at some outpost, decided to go look to see what happened, and they found him. He survived, but only because they found him and they were able to get him to the hospital and get him treatment, and he was okay. Now, the mother of this yeshiva student who was shot felt like tremendous gratitude. She didn't even know who saved her son. And she herself owned a pharmacy in the neighborhood. And she really wanted to meet the person, but nobody really knew. So she put up a sign in her pharmacy: if anybody knows who saved my son, at this and this time and place, people heard the story, of course, please let me know. And one day a woman comes in and sees it, and sees the sign, and tells her, I want you to know that there was actually my son who saved your son. So she said, wow, incredible. And she said, actually, let me just make sure I'm getting the story right. So she said to her that my son saved your son, but do you know who I am? And she said, no. And she said, I want to remind you who I am. It was 20 some years ago, and I came in here and was a pharmacy, as we said. I came in here to buy medications related to aborting my pregnancy. and you, this is the mother of the boy who was shot, who's behind the counter, you took me to the side, dropped everything you were doing in your store, and you really spoke to me from your heart and talked me out of it. And I want you to know that I had my son because of you. And the son that I had because of you ended up saving your son.
That's amazing.
So with that, we conclude this discussion. And ultimately, we don't know everything. We think we do sometimes, but God has a plan. And with hope and prayer, we only know of healthy pregnancies and many blessings of health and happiness. Amen. Thank you.